The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
I thought I would talk on the same topic as I talked on last night. I gave a talk here last night. And so if some of you were here last night, I apologize for repeating myself. It's part of the occupational hazard of being a Dharma teacher. You get to repeat yourself a lot. Buddhism traditionally has not called itself a religion, but rather it's called itself a path. And a path is something that you're not meant to admire from a distance, but rather it's something you're meant to walk, to enter into and engage in. And so what does it mean for Buddhism to be a path? What does it mean for there to be a path? And in the history of Buddhism, there are different answers to that question. There are different approaches to the path. And I'd like to offer about three approaches that people take. They're not exclusive of each other, but there are times where sometimes teachers or different traditions even will choose one over the others to be their primary emphasis. And the three approaches to the path is the first one is the idea of a developmental path. The second is a path of letting go. And the third is a path of no path, that there is no path. So the developmental model of the path is utilizes kind of our ordinary experience of many things in life, in human life, are developmental. Our children grow developmentally, and our school systems is built around helping the children to develop and learn. And there are stages in human growth that don't end at 18, but also continue into old age. And people develop. It's kind of very obvious. We develop skills, capacities. We develop, so if you learn a musical instrument, you start off perhaps with no ability at all, and then through regular practice, you develop that capacity. Or in sports, you develop a capacity there. You learn a language. You start not knowing it at all, but through a lot of practice, it develops more and more. So the same thing with our inner life. So-called spiritual life or psychological life, things can be developed there. We can develop our capacity for patience. We can develop our capacity for becoming concentrated. In fact, a lot of skills require some degree of concentration, so sometimes we develop concentration with a skill. We can develop our capacity for integrity, honesty. We can develop our capacity for greater mindfulness, for compassion, for joy, for happiness, for equanimity, for calm. A lot of these things can be developed, and so we're not just left with how we just happen to be, given how we're born or whatever, causes and conditions, but we can actually choose to develop certain qualities that we have because we feel it's beneficial to do that. If you find yourself being miserly all the time, and you feel this is not a good way of living, maybe I'll cultivate not just the act of being generous, but a greater spirit of generosity, and I'll see what I can do to develop that and cultivate that. greater listening skills. Some people realize that they don't listen very much to their friends or to their loved ones or something, and after being told that 100 times, they think, well, maybe I better learn to listen better, and so we develop our capacity to listen, and maybe it takes a while to learn that. We develop our capacity at discernment, to reflect, to think critically, to think wisely about things. And so all these things can be learned and developed, and it's quite beautiful to meet someone who you feel has developed some of these qualities. We see an athlete who is proficient and wonderful, you know, has mastered certain kind of sports, and it's often quite beautiful to see that, or an artist or a musician. And the same way with some people who develop some of these beautiful inner qualities. And we can meet people who have a very high degree of integrity, or a very strong sense of inner discipline, or have a strong sense of a calm, or loving kindness, a variety of things. And it can be inspiring to meet someone, not only because they have those qualities, it can be inspiring because we've seen them develop those qualities. You can feel how that's been built over time. And as a teacher, I've been a teacher long enough now to have watched the students start off by being new students and then practicing and practicing and practicing over the years, and then to see how much they grow and develop over time. And it's quite inspiring to me to see the change, especially given where some of you started. Speak nothing about myself. I was a mess. And so classically, Buddhism has taken this developmental model to heart for understanding the path. Someone who is interested in the path that the Buddha taught would then engage in developing some of these inner qualities. Because some qualities that we can develop are supportive of a path to liberation, to freedom, are supportive for the path that the Buddha was teaching. There are certainly qualities which are not helpful for the path. In poker, it's really good to develop a skill to have a, you know, I don't, do they lie in poker? Is that what they do? Or are they kind of bluff, you know? And some people have this great capacity, and you can train and develop that capacity, and it's a really great skill if you want to play poker. It's not, I never heard it ever had any role in Dharma practice. So that's not a skill to be developed, you know, it's not emphasized. So there's skills to be developed and skills to be avoided. And so there's a whole set of skills which then the tradition emphasizes. And so a lot of these skills are there to help us learn how to meditate, or to help us have a calm and stable mind so that we feel good about ourselves, so that it's possible to have a stable mind so we can have deeper insight into our life. So practices like ethics is very, very important. Practices of generosity, practices of loving kindness, compassion. These are all important qualities because they develop ourselves, they develop good qualities, these skills inside of us. And also they're a foundation for feeling good about ourselves. And both the skills that come with doing those practices and the feeling good about ourselves are very helpful then for engaging in the further steps of the path, like meditation practice, for example. And then as at some point when the mind heart is well developed, it becomes very strong and stable and calm and centered, not agitated by the things of the world, has kind of like great stability, then it's sometimes it's possible to see into the nature of our life in a way that's not possible if the mind is agitated. Now the disadvantage of, or the shadow side of this path of development, is that the goal is sometimes put far into the future. And the goal is held up also as kind of as something to attain. And as soon as we have something to attain, there are a number of people who will tie themselves in knots in trying to attain it, or tie themselves in knots in comparing themselves. Well, I'm not good enough for that. It's too lofty for me. I could never do that. Or I've been trying this for a long time and I've only made a smidgen of progress, or in fact I've gone backwards. And so can be very discouraging. There's unfortunate thing of people comparing themselves to others. I'm so much better than everyone else, thank you. You know, I've reached something, or you know, everyone else seems to be on the verge of Buddhahood, and why am I so far behind? Sometimes in putting off the idea of the goal is in the future, sometimes people don't appreciate the present very much. The present becomes something that's not very desirable or important or valuable because in the present is not the goal, and so we have to kind of figure out how to work with the present just enough to get beyond it. Sometimes teachings of transcendence or avoidance or dismissive or world-renouncing kind of qualities come up when there's a kind of an emphasis of a goal that's far into the future. Then there's a second approach, which I'm calling the path of letting go. And there are some teachers who will emphasize, just let go, let go, let go. Just do whatever you can to let go. And often supporting this idea, this path of letting go, is that there are clouds in front of the sun, and if we can just clear the clouds, we'll see the sun. So if we can just clear away our attachments, our greed, our hate, if we can clear away our things we hold on to, our distracted mind, our preoccupations of our mind, if we can clear away things, then something beautiful within us, something radiant, will shine forth. So it's not a matter of developing something that's radiant, but rather clearing the field, or clearing the space to realize that the radiance is always here. It tends to be a very positive message because it has the idea that inherent in us is some very good quality, some inherent goodness or something. It's just a matter of clearing away to experience it. So we let go of a lot of doing. And meditation, in this case, is not a matter of doing something, getting concentrated, but letting go of the distractions, letting go of the preoccupations that maybe would keep us from getting concentrated. The results might be the same, but in the developmental path, it would be a little bit more like, I'm going to hold my mind at an act of strong will and be concentrated. The letting go path would be, I'm not going to do anything to get concentrated. I'm just going to let go of all the distractions. And then you find yourself settling into a kind of more concentrated space. The idea of letting go lends itself sometimes to the unfortunate circumstance of people letting go of things they shouldn't let go of. People can be over-enthusiastic about letting go. And sometimes it's very nice to simplify one's life radically, but sometimes the letting go happens with a kind of dismissive quality, like these things are bad that I have. So there are people I've known who've given away all their money, thinking money was evil. Or they've given up their sexuality, or given up all kinds of things, thinking that made them more spiritual. I believe the idea in Buddhism is the path is not made up of letting go of things, but rather letting go of our clinging to things. And if there's no clinging to things, whether we're useful to keep the things, that's another question. But it's the core issue is our clinging to things, not the things themselves. So in letting go of clinging. Also, when the path is a path of letting go, sometimes the emphasis is on precludes really understanding what it is we're letting go of. The path of development often has a very important part of seeing clearly, learning to be discerning and understanding of what goes on. The path of letting go, sometimes you can let go of things too quickly, and you haven't really learned the lessons of that. You haven't really seen, understood what it is you're letting go of. Part of the danger of that is that if you don't understand what you let go of, often it comes back. But if you really understand something well, then it's less likely to come back and bother us, or it comes back in a different roundabout way. Now these two paths, path of development, path of letting go, can also be seen as mutually supportive. If you want to learn how to hang from the edge of the diving board and let go, which is a nice thing, I used to do it as a kid, it's fun. But at first you want to learn how to swim. So certain kinds of letting go, maybe it's better to develop yourself, develop some inner strength, some inner stability, develop some greater self-understanding or develop greater street smarts about how to be in the world before we let go of certain things. So they can be supportive that way, those two paths. Also, it's easier to develop ourselves if we let go. So there are things which if we hold on to, it's hard to develop the good qualities. So we have to also learn how to let go. Now, the path of no path is a little bit hard to discuss, partly because there are maybe different approaches within that path too, sub-paths within that, or sub-understandings. The path of no path is that says that there is no path, that there's no ultimate, there's no place to go, nothing to get, that ultimate reality is right here and now. And the very idea that there's progress and something to attain is a kind of delusion, an illusion. And what we have to do is we have to wake up out of that dream of progress, wake up out of the dream of separation from the reality, true reality. And in fact, the very idea that there's a path and progress to be made belongs to the realm of delusion and actually keeps you in the realm of delusion. And so rather than helping you become free, it actually maybe keeps you from being free. And what we have to do is just wake up directly into the true nature of ultimate reality, which is here right now. The problem with that is, how do you do that? How are you supposed to do that, wake up like that? That's nice for you to tell me, thank you, but, now what? And I'm not supposed to have a path, I'm not supposed to practice, but I don't see it the way you see it, so what am I supposed to do? It's a little bit ironic, I think, that sometimes the paths of no paths, sometimes we'll put a tremendous emphasis on teachers. Teachers become very important, because the teacher, it's either you have it or you don't have it. And the teacher has it, and the teacher points it out, and then if somehow the charisma or the power of the teacher kind of wakes you up or shows it to you or something, and sometimes that works great. I know people who go for their hit, and then they, after it wears off, they come back again for another hit of ultimate reality. And so, of course, ultimate reality has no path, and however, the road to the teacher is well worn. but it's another reason why the no path is very very compelling is that it's a little bit the perspective of life from the point of view of someone who has some degree of spiritual maturity, of awakening. When there's some degree of awakening, often our present moment is seen as being complete. Or some people talk about it feels perfect, just the way things are perfect, just the way they are. And a little bit that happens because with awakening, there is a dropping away of comparative thinking, neurotically comparing. And most suffering that human beings have around self, I think happens because of some kind of comparative thinking. We compare ourselves to others. I'm better, I'm worse. I compare myself to ideals. I'm better and worse than that ideal that I'm supposed to live by, the shoulds. We compare ourselves to past and future. We have ideas about the future and how it should be. We have ideas about the past, what happened, and we look at it, we measure ourselves. And there's a constant measuring of things. And the measuring of our life, measuring of ourselves, often has involves a degree of virtual reality in that it has to do with ideas and concepts that have very little to do with what's actually happening here and now. So, I mean, if I told you all that I suffer horribly because I just, I don't speak Uyghur. You don't even know what Uyghur is, do you? Uyghur is a dead language that they spoke in parts of Turkey. So, we wonder, what's going on with Gil? That he's suffering because of not speaking Uyghur. that's kind of silly. But there's a lot of reasons we suffer because we hold on to ideas and memories. We hold on to projections into the future, how things should be. There's a lot of anxiety. A lot of anxiety people have is about maybe all anxiety, as opposed to fear. All anxiety is about things that are imaginary. Fear is more real. You know, something that's more concrete. You know, the mountain lion is walking down Birch Street, and so you see it. But to be anxious that there's a mountain lion walking down Birch Street, that's imaginary. You know, if you see it, it's not. But so to be awake is to stop. Is to wake up, partly to wake up from the way our thinking and our measuring and comparing is constantly engaged in understanding our life. And if we stop that comparative thinking, you just see life as it actually is in the immediacy here and now, more often than not, it tends to be experienced as being beautiful. I've known people who have walked out of a retreat center after meditating for some days, and seen trash on the side of the road. And they'll stand there in awe looking at that trash. Wow, isn't that beautiful? Wow, look how it glistens, that candy wrapper, the silver. It's amazing. And as opposed to, some other, just because so many things glisten and stand out. Well, the first time I had some experience like this, not only did the world around me seem so beautiful in a way I had never seen before. It was like, am I on drugs? It's so beautiful. I wasn't. It was just, things stood out in highlight and clarity. But also my inner life stood out with great clarity. And I felt this tremendous intimacy with thoughts, with feelings. Nothing was bad, nothing was good. It was just things happening, arising and happening So the path of no path is partly a path where we don't succumb to the temptations of comparing and measuring ourselves. And as I said earlier, the very idea of having a goal in the future can lead to kind of neurotic preoccupation about something imaginary. The goal is imaginary if it's not attained here and now. And so the path of no path emphasizes partly letting go of ideas of path, ideas of attainment, and just relaxing and just being fully present here and having some kind of insight into this experience of life right here. So I talked about how the first two paths, the path of development and the path of letting go, can work together. So all three can work together as well. We can develop ourselves to some degree so that we're strong enough to be able to let go of certain things. So we develop our mindfulness enough so we see how much I'm clinging to security. So then I can see, I think it'd be useful to let go of that clinging to security because that's really, preoccupying me a lot, interfering with my life. So then you can let go of that insecurity, which allows us perhaps to focus more on developing more mindfulness and greater clarity. As the mindfulness gets stronger, we see how much we're caught up in ideas. And maybe it's possible to drop the ideas. And then dropping ideas gives us an insight or a vision of life without always being mediated through concepts, ideas, measurements, and comparisons. And that can be quite a beautiful thing to see. Wow, look at that. It says life is simpler than I realized. To be happy is simpler than I realized. And that happiness then supports, may perhaps encourages us to develop more mindfulness. The greater mindfulness helps us to see deeper places, more subtle places where we're still holding and where we can let go, which in itself provides greater insight, greater understanding, greater vision of what it's like to have a mind which is free, which is free. So, three different ways of the path. Some people love to do, and it doesn't matter if they get anywhere. They just like the activity, being engaged. Some people don't like to do, and the less they can do, the better. And so sometimes letting go is really good for people who don't want to do. Just let go, because it's more relaxing to let go. Sometimes the path of no path, people fool themselves. They think they've attained something, but mostly the path of no path. I've seen some teachers who teach it. It's very conceptual, where they have this beautiful kind of arguments of why there should be no path, how things are ultimate here and now, and then people kind of get it. You get kind of an intuitive sense of it, or a conceptual sense of it, and then people relate to that conceptual sense of it, rather than some deep insight. Also, both the path of path of letting go and the path of no path tends to limit how much self-understanding people develop. The path of development tends to come with much more understanding the cause and conditions, understanding our psychology and how we work. The path of no path, there's no need for a path, there's no need to learn anything. And so sometimes then there's not a greater understanding about our psychology, how we work, how we take, how we operate. And so sometimes there's a kind of, I've seen in various Buddhist schools that have the no path approach, certain kind of mythologies arising. And so mythology, kind of supernatural almost beliefs become important because they don't have the traditional Buddhist psychology to understand how we operate deep inside. So finally, what I would like to say about maybe one or two more things. The path, a path can have two different functions. A path can be a path that takes you someplace, and a path can be a path that you walk just because you enjoy the vista, you just enjoy the walk. And so the Buddhist path can have both ways as well. It can take you someplace, but also each step along the way can be enjoyable. And I think this is very important. I believe it's very important to have both things in mind. That the Buddhist path does take us someplace to greater freedom, greater compassion. But also that each step along the way is satisfying and meaningful. And I'd encourage all of you who are engaged in mindfulness practice and Buddhist practice to see if you can find an understanding of what you're doing so that you understand that each moment of mindfulness, each day of practice was meaningful, was satisfying, was significant. Because to only measure the value of the path by where you get or where you're going to get lends itself to discouragement, lends itself to disappointment, lends itself to striving and pushing too hard, and lends itself to not appreciating a certain level of joy and satisfaction that's possible to have each step along the way. And the more each step along the way is meaningful and satisfying, the more we're going to want to walk that path and be supported by it, be nourished by it. I've known people who have huffed and puffed in their Buddhist practice and felt they didn't attain anything and then felt bitter. I put so much time and effort into this Buddhism stuff and it failed or something and now I'm bitter. But if we really truly understand that one moment of mindfulness, to see clearly what's happening here, to let go of some kind of clinging we have right here and now, that is satisfying. If you put your hand on a hot stove, it's satisfying to remove it. If you are clinging to something, hopefully you see that it's satisfying to let go of that clinging. It's a relief that comes there. That a moment of mindfulness is meaningful. And I'd like to say that a moment of mindfulness is a moment of seeing something clearly for what it is without being for and against what we're mindful of. Awakening is to be fully present and see this reality we're living in with a mind not being for or against this experience. With consciousness not being for or against. I said that because both mindfulness and awakening share very similar qualities. And it's possible to understand that the goal of freedom is reflected in the means. And I think it's very useful to keep that as a kind of background approach to engaging in the path, is that the goal should be reflected in the means. Meaning that if the goal is to be awake, then start paying attention. If the goal is to be free of clinging, start letting go of your clinging now. If the goal is to be generous, start practicing generosity. If the goal is to become compassionate, start practicing compassion. If the goal is to be peaceful, start being peaceful. Somehow, the goal and the means and the goal shouldn't be seen as being so separate from each other, but rather they exist kind of together. One grows into the other. One matures. Our capacity for mindfulness our practice of mindfulness matures into awakening. Our practice of letting go matures into freedom. Our practice of peace matures into a greater sense of peace. Our practice of kindness matures into great loving kindness. So it's not an all or nothing kind of thing, which is one of the traps that some people have when they do Buddhist practice, is they think, oh, there is a path, and it's just, I'm going to, you know, do something for a little while, and then I'll discover the keys to enlightenment, and it'll be this bang, big bang, sudden, dramatic opening experience, and that's it. Now I'm awakened. And people sit there waiting for that big bang, waiting for that experience. And I don't know if, you know, there are experiences, and there are momentary, very powerful experiences to be had, but I think a more mature approach to the path is that it's a slow growth, it's a slow unfolding, it's a slow development, it's a slow manifestation of who we are, of this development. And as we go along the path, there are sometimes when the developmental side of it is most meaningful and significant, sometimes when it's the letting go side of it which is most significant and meaningful, and sometimes what's most significant is the idea that there is no path, but that it's what's to be attained or what's to be experienced is right here and now. Whichever understanding of your path you have, I would like to say that in Buddhism, there is no obligation for you to walk the path. There's no obligation. I think in some religions there's some sense of some kind of divine obligation to live a certain kind of way. In Buddhism, there's no obligation. So you don't become more worthy. You know your inherent worthiness is not dependent on following the path. But I think it's useful to think we're already inherently worthy people. And then on top of that, there's a path that you might want to walk. If you're interested in becoming happy and free in the way that Buddhism talks about, then Buddhism does offer a path for that possibility. And so if you're interested, you can volunteer. And if you're not interested, then there are certainly other things to do. So we have a couple of minutes here. If anyone wants to ask any questions, yes, in the back there.
This is one of those idea questions that's been making me think for a while. You started out by saying Buddhism wasn't a religion. Rather, it was a path. Can you clarify in what ways it is or isn't a religion?
Which way it is a religion?
It is or isn't a religion.
Well, I need to clarify then, because we're in public here. You know, it's being recorded. We are definitely a religion. Because our nonprofit status depends on it. We're just a religion that calls itself a path. And I've been told that back in the Soviet Union days, that the Buddhists in Russia, back in the Soviet Union, they would say, we're not a religion. Because back in the Soviet times, being a religion was not so, you know, communist times, not so good. Religion is the opiate of the masses kind of thing, right? So so Buddhism is quite flexible. You know, we're kind of, you know, religion, not religion, you know, we'll play whatever game is useful. The word religion is a Western word. And religare in Italian, or Latin, to join together. And so you could do all kinds of beautiful things about It's a joining together of people around certain common ideals. It's joining together with something that's ultimate. But what is religion? I have a degree in religious studies, and one of the first things you do when you take classes in religious studies, the professors and students will pull out their hair, struggling to come up with a definition of what religion is. And religious studies professors have a hard time with it. And one of the reasons is that, because of Buddhism. Because a lot of the definitions of religion have God, some kind of God thing, and God's kind of at the center of it. And then they say, well, the Buddhists, they don't have this God in the same way. But it's a religion. How do we fit it in now? And so, but it's a Western idea, concept, a word. And what's interesting is that I think that when Western languages like English were translated into Japanese or Hindi or different kind of things, they didn't have an easy word for the English word religion, because it wasn't a native word. And so I know in Japan they invented a word to translate the English word or the Western word religion into Japanese. So now they have a perfectly good word, but they had to invent it about, 120 years ago, I don't know when. So it raises the question of what does it mean to be religion and how do we define it? And there are many definitions of religion. Some people don't like the word religion at all, or they don't like being part of religion. And people will say, I'm not religious, I'm spiritual. And then, so that works for some people. But then you have to find, what does it mean to, different people have different definitions of religion. Different people have different definitions of God or spirituality. So you almost have to ask, how do you define these words for yourself? And so in contrasting Buddhism with, saying it's not a religion, it's a path, if what a religion is, see, many people in the West associate religion with tenets of belief. And in Buddhism, there are kind of beliefs and kind of tenets, but that's not really the point. It's not so important, the articles of faith that this is what I believe in and I'll kill if other people believe differently. But rather, what's important is the practice, the praxis part. And so that's why a path is a more useful label for Buddhism than, maybe perhaps a religion. Or we could say we're a religious path, or I don't know. So I know I'm going on and on. But is that adequate?
I'm wondering, is mindfulness enough? I mean, can I just focus on mindfulness as opposed to a path?
For what purpose? What are you trying to accomplish?
Freedom from the clinging and the suffering.
Is mindfulness enough to become free of clinging and suffering? What do you think, for yourself?
That's all I'm doing.
That's all you're doing.
It's helping.
So
but I don't know if that's going to run out of gas.
Can you think of something else you might be able to do, or that maybe you're already doing, that might be supportive of that goal of freedom from clinging?
This is where I get confused.
Mm-hmm. So, a very simple thing is you came here today. So, listening to Dharma, hopefully you think it's helpful. That's why you're here. So that's one thing. There's a discourse the Buddha gave where he's in a dialogue with some kind of deity. And the deity says something like, mindfulness is enough. And the Buddha says, nope. He said, mindfulness and loving kindness together are enough. That sometimes you need to have loving kindness as well as part of it. So you might, for example, experiment and see if cultivating greater loving kindness supports both your mindfulness and your capacity to become free. So, you know, and you might look at, for example, practices like wise speech. Can you, if you really take on looking at speech and working with speech, working with some of the guidelines around speech, will that help you become mindful? Will that help you in this process? Will that develop certain qualities that support what you're doing? Classically, in the mindfulness tradition that we are, it's considered very, very helpful to couple concentration with mindfulness. So not just let mindfulness be there by itself, but also develop concentration, strong concentration. Some teachers say that concentration follows nicely in the wake of mindfulness practice, and some teachers say you should actually cultivate concentration separately and then at some point wed these two together. So there's a variety of things, but you know, I would put it back on you to use your mindfulness and then have a spirit of trial and error. It's a great question you asked. And see if we go run late. You see, we have all kinds of problems. I think that one of the wonderful approaches to any notion of a Buddhist path or Buddhist practice is to approach it as a trial and error approach. And with a trial and error, it's useful to remember that there's going to be a lot of error, and we learn from that. So occasionally people say there actually is no path. The path is always trying to find your, the path is made up of looking for it. But another idea of the path is that the path, there is a path, but mostly you're not on it. Mostly you're swinging back and forth. It's like, you know, usually we don't hold our car completely straight on the freeway. It's, you know, mostly straight. We're within our lane. But, you know, there's little, you know, moving back and forth, a little bit, you know, a little bit to the right, a little bit to the left. And we're making constant course corrections. So the same thing with the Buddhist path. Maybe sometimes we're in the lanes, sometimes we're... but we experiment and we learn from that. Oh, that didn't work. Or, you know, I've been doing this mindfulness-only thing for 5 years and it seems good, but I wonder if I'm missing out on something. Maybe I'll try something else. Maybe I'll try this loving-kindness practice for a while. And then you do that for a while and you realize, that's really good, I'll do more of it. That's really helpful, I'll do even more of it. Oh, that was too much. I better go back to the mindfulness now. So we trial and error. And in that regard, I'm inspired by the example of American baseball, where really good players fail 2/3 of the time. So don't be afraid of error, of failing. And perhaps spiritual life is that way too. Our batting averages are pretty low. But enjoy the process. Enjoy each step along the way and have each step along the way be meaningful. And so if anything I want to underscore about the talk today is that if you're interested in this practice of mindfulness and the Buddhist path, try to find a way, a personal way, a way of understanding what you're doing when you do practice, so that each moment of practice is meaningful. Maybe not dramatically meaningful, but each moment is you find, oh, this is worthwhile to do. Even when it's a struggle, even when it's a challenge, and you know, even when you don't want to do it even, there's something about it which is inherently valuable. And then you'll never be disappointed. You'll always look back at the practice you've done and say, oh, that was worthwhile. So, thank you.